That's such a, in all my conversations and studies of awe for 15 years, this is one of the most original hard ideas I've heard. And I think you're right. I think there's something in literally the DNA of awe that, you know, it's like a basic state of mind, and it's, you can't alter it, or corrupt it in some sense. And then the task is to, for us, is to create the context where we can really put it to good uses and feel it.
Hey everyone, Ronan here. You're listening to A Good Long Podcast, Lessons for a Good Long Life. Want to know something that's awesome? Getting to spend some of my time having conversations with people like Dacher Keltner. Why? Well, for one, as you'll hear in this conversation, Dacher is just a genuinely good human who's had some very cool and very powerful life experiences. And second, because we get to dive into a very interesting subject, awe. Hence the very insightfully humorous name of this episode, if I do say so myself. Talking about things like awe is so interesting to me because if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, it probably won't come as a huge surprise that when it comes to emotions, I can be pretty even keel. In fact, this was a choice I made consciously when I was a kid. Well, I'll spare you all the details of my childhood, although many of them are sprinkled through the episodes of this podcast. I still remember the moment that I decided that I would become a ship that would not be rocked. I couldn't tell you at what age it was or where it happened, but I remember being severely upset about something and realizing that if I was going to navigate this life, I couldn't, or at least didn't want to, let myself feel as deflated as I did in that moment. So I decided I was going to become that ship. And that largely worked for me until my early 30s, when I realized that life is a lot more meaningful and interesting, and you can become a lot more powerful when you let yourself feel the depth of your emotions. Details of that revelation are for another day, but as part of that exploration, I became aware that to learn how to feel my emotions, I also needed to understand them and to practice them, as weird as that may sound. So when I came across a book all about understanding and practicing awe, kind of like my friends Alex and UJ have done for gratitude with the 5-Minute Journal, I had to jump at the chance to dive in. Let me tell you a bit about Dacher before we get started. He is the founding director of the Greater Good Science Center, what a cool name for an organization, and a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. He is recognized as one of the world's foremost emotion scientists with over 200 scientific publications and 6 books, including The Power Paradox, Born to Be Good, and the book we are discussing today, Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. He also has the notable distinction, for anyone who has young kids, of being the scientific advisor behind Pixar's Inside Out and its recently released sequel, Inside Out 2. I hope you find this conversation as awe-inspiring as I did. Well, it's remarkable how hard it is to get good internet around here.
Oh, man.
Anyway.
In my very department of UC Berkeley, there's terrible internet. So, yeah. I take it as a sign of cultural sophistication.
And what makes it so sophisticated?
Because we know how to communicate without this technological interference. So
that's a good way to look at it. That's a good point. It is a good point. You know, it sometimes concerns me how reliant we are on digital technology and how easy it can all collapse like that. And
oh yeah.
Yeah. But before we go down that very pessimistic exploration, let's start on a little bit of a more positive note. So we'd love to get your background. I know in the book you talk about growing up in Southern California in the late 60s, having some pretty auspicious neighbors. I wasn't alive. I was born in 1979, but I've always been a huge fan and had a great interest of what life must have been like in the 60s. So
yeah,
tell us your story growing up at that time.
Yeah, well, you know, I was born in Mexico and in 1961, and my parents both were from LA, and then upon returning after a while we moved to Laurel Canyon in 1968, and I was 7 or 8. And you know, now we know historically it was, I mean, it was one of the great moments of, you know, rock and roll. And, you know, it was in just a very small canyon in the Hollywood Hills. There was Joni Mitchell and the Mamas and Papas and the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and, you know, on and on, Jim Morrison. And so And it was a wild time socially. You know, drugs and sex were, you know, you kind of sense them as a young kid. And then it was a very important time politically. I remember, you know, my parents being very upset about the Vietnam War, Nixon, and then civil rights and Martin Luther King's death. I remember vividly. And so it was a transformative time, and it felt like a hotspot of that transformation. And as a kid, you kind of liked it, you know, because you're like, these adults are crazy and they're wearing weird clothes and they're putting flowers in their hair and they dance kind of funny, you know, and they're all, and there's a lot of drugs. And so, you know, it was, I think in some sense, liberating as a young kid to see adults, you know, and these are adults who are making films and doing good work and teaching, and but it was just a kind of an opening in our culture, and I felt liberated.
I'm just looking up a quote from Tom Robbins that I'm going to reflect to you, and just to get your response. Do you know the author Tom Robbins?
I know the name. I haven't read Tom Robbins, so.
Okay. Well, I will implore upon you to read Still Life with Woodpecker and Jitterbug Perfume, because they are two of the most influential books, even though they're entirely fiction. There's just a magic of them. But in Jitterbug Perfume, he said, like the Arthurian years at Camelot, the 60s constituted a breakthrough, a fleeting moment of glory, a time when a significant little chunk of humanity briefly realized its moral potential and flirted with its neurological destiny, a collective spiritual awakening that flared brilliantly until the barbaric and mediocre impulses of the species drew tight once more the curtains of darkness. Just curious to know, does that resonate with you? As a 7 or 8 year old at the time, did you feel that, or do you appreciate it more in hindsight now?
I think I felt the beginnings of it, you know, Ronan, you just like the return to nature, the wild camping, the celebratory tendencies, dancing, and, you know, and the political opening of that time was very important. The anti-war movement was a profoundly important movement that we're still feeling today in the United States. So yeah, I felt it. And I think it laid this foundation, you know, just the generational divide around civil rights. You know, my dad, proponent, his father not. So it was an opening, as Tom Robbins said, and that's a wonderful quote. Thank you for bringing it to my attention.
My pleasure. It continues to inspire me to this day.
Yeah.
And do you think your direction professionally was informed by a lot of this, or do you think this was kind of your destiny, regardless of growing up in Laurel Canyon, or had you grown up in, I don't know, Dallas, Texas, as a alternative? Who were you as a young boy?
I think scientifically, what I think I was, you know, meant to be a scientist. My grandfather was a chemist. Then my parents shifted to the humanities. And so in that generational back and forth, you know, science and math just appealed to me. I think my parents gave me my interest scientifically in awe, which is, you know, my dad loved, he was a painter. He loved Goya and Francis Bacon and wild stuff. And my mom taught literature and loved Virginia Woolf and the Romantic poets. So they just filled me with, you know, all the possibility of awe. And I'm not a very good fiction writer. I was not good at art. I wish I would have been a good fiction writer. I'd probably much rather be a novelist. But so I was like, okay, you know, I do well in science, so that's what I should do. And then I think what Laurel Canyon gave me is an interest in the idea that knowledge can be a form of activism. And so even in the book, you know, just my science got me into prisons, and my science gets me to educational issues, and my science gets me to the study of psychedelics and the implications. So I had this sense in watching the people, the young adults around me at that time, like, yeah, we gotta change things, you know, it's a necessity, and whatever means you can.
Gotcha. We will dive much more into the book, but I had some kind of preliminary questions. So you've been studying human emotions, it sounds, for certainly your professional career, but I suspect probably your entire life. And before Awe, the book you have recently published, you had published two books, one called Born to Be Good and the other called The Power Paradox. Well, I didn't have a chance to read those. I would surmise that one of the core theses across all of your work is somewhat as an antidote to Richard Dawkins' hypothesis in the selfish gene. Loosely speaking, is that a fair assessment?
I mean, I think that, and thank you for that observation. I think, the countering of the cynicism, the ideological cynicism that's so prevalent about human beings has always been an animating force in my life. And, when I was a young scientist and I started to read about evolution, Richard Dawkins, The Selfish Gene, 1978, it's one thing to say that genes are selfish, but then the language that he uses to make the case is just, it's pure aggression and violence and genocide. And, and I'm just like, wait a minute, there's a lot of cooperation going on amongst genes. And then more broadly, I think my field, emotion science, psychological science, emotion science had this funny fight or flight bias in it, which is like, oh, the basic states of consciousness or feeling are fear and anger and disgust, self-protection mechanisms.
Right.
And my experience in its own right was like, God, I love intensely. I feel compassion feels as fundamental as anything I've ever felt. Awe has the same neurophysiological primacy as other kinds of like fear. And so I was like, there's more to it than just this narrow version of self-interest. And as I review in Awe and other publications, like evolutionary science has transformed. It's now about cooperation and interconnectedness and altruism. So that book really unsettled me and animated a lot of work that would follow.
Yeah, just for some reason, it's not just in human interconnectedness that we're talking about right now, too, right? Yeah. Like if you look at, I come from the psychedelic industry. That's what animated this podcast initially. And I certainly wasn't a psychedelic proponent before I got too much into the industry. But you read about, mushrooms and the mycelial network and how trees cooperate and all of this kind of stuff. And it's illuminating and in many ways almost shocking that that would be the fundamental nature of how nature works, but it really comes to light. People are like, whoa, I never even thought about that.
Yeah,
it's absolutely, it's interesting.
And even Michael Pollan, I think in one of his early talks on psychedelics, he's like, this is kind of a symbiotic relationship. These plants give us these remarkable experiences and we do things that make them expand in their genetic presence. So our thinking about human beings ebbs and flows, but I felt it viscerally, but I also thought, we've got the tools of this science to study things like compassion or awe to tell us something new about human nature.
I'm curious to know your thoughts, even though I feel like maybe we should cover it later in the book. Did you ever, I guess I'll ask two questions. One is, it sounds like awe has been a theme in your life, but do you remember the moment or what the catalyzing experience was when you decided, I have to write a book about this specifically? And then B, and you can maybe answer this question beforehand, because I think I know the answer to some degree of my first question is, did you ever worry that the science of awe is almost antithetical to the nature of awe, that by dissecting it to some degree, poor choice of words, but I think it relates to the point, that you're taking away something from it?
Yeah. Wow. Two really deep questions, Ronan. Yeah. I wrote the book. I was going to write the book because we were doing a lot of science of awe and it's a fascinating topic. But then my brother died you know, right. And, you know, it's just past 5 years since he passed away. And, that it, the moment of his passing was transcendent, you know, like a lot of people feel when they watch a sibling go or a parent, you know, it was just like, wow, what is life? And what's this mystery? Why does it end? What I felt like I saw his soul in some ways. And so I was like, that's incredible. And then I got lost in very deep grief that Joan Didion writes about, of just almost psychosis. And I needed to find my bearings and my way in life. And I did it through awe. So I wrote the book out of that, you know, and it just started flowing out. And most of it was not sensible, but I had to do it. And then, you know, I got interested in the science personally when my first daughter was born. And I was just like, you know, I just like watched her be born. And I was like, this is so overwhelming and so transformative and such a rich lesson into what our what humans are capable of, that I had to study it. So did you have a second question? First one was why the book?
The second question was, the second one was, did you ever worry that, you know, categorizing
that's a terrific and
scientifically
question.
Approaching awe would undermine it?
Yeah, that, you know, sorry.
Thank you.
You know, that one I worried about because it would be a deep irony if I did all this research and then it knocked out the phenomenon that I was hoping to promote. That would be sad.
Yeah.
And then personally, I was like, I wonder if I apply all these statistics and measures and to awe, would it undermine it in my own life? And the opposite is true empirically. We know the more people practice awe, the more they learn about it, the more intense they feel it. And then, you know, Rhonda and I found the more that I studied it, the more I wrote about it, the deeper and more pervasive it became. And you know, it just became almost omnipresent in my daily life. And I think that speaks to just the fact that awe is always mysterious. It's always tricking us. It's always expanding our thinking. You can't really reduce it to measures or words. And when we try to understand it with measures and words, we get close to it, and it impels us to learn more about it. So it actually enhanced my own experience of the feeling.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. You touched on it with talking about your brother's passing, about seeing his soul, or at least having that experience. And I choose those words carefully because as a scientist, it's always a little bit of a tricky conversation to talk about spirituality or metaphysics or the things that are beyond measure. How do you reconcile that for yourself?
Yeah, it's still a puzzle and a mystery and a wonderful question to this day. I believe that, as William James believed, and as the new science of spirit medicines or psychedelics is showing, that humans have the deepest spiritual feelings and experiences, and they're wonders, and we can understand those scientifically. It does not answer the ontological question about reality, which is, do they really exist? You know, it's really pertains to the subjective sense of spirituality. But that's enough for me. You know, I don't think science will ever prove like that's what the spirit is, or it's located in this little part of the mitochondria or the cell or in your brain. But it will say a lot about the depths of the experience in the human nervous system in our conscious lives. And that's profound, you know? For me personally, the writing the book was this fascinating opening where I wasn't terribly interested personally in matters of the spirit or soul.
Right.
And then my brother dies and I feel like, and I, you know, after his death for years. I sensed his presence. I felt his hand on my shoulder. I heard his voice. I saw his face. You know, he was everywhere. And I was like, you know, this is fascinating. And we can get close to it scientifically. Maybe quantum physics has applied to human experience. We'll figure it out. I don't think so. But it is a wonderful thing for science to just try to understand. And I think, you know, more broadly, thanks to psychedelic science, thanks to the science of awe, a lot of people are now more interested in what William James was interested in, which is, you know, how do we make sense with science of this universal feeling of spirit?
Yeah. It's fascinating to me. And anyone listening to the podcast has probably heard me tell this story a few times, but when we first opened Field Trip, which was primarily providing ketamine assisted therapy, but we also did psilocybin assisted therapy in the Netherlands where we were allowed to, we had a reporter, I think from Popular Mechanics, come through, and, and I don't think she had ever experienced ketamine before, but she talked about how after her experience, she looked at her hands. I'm inclined to say with awe, but I'm going to say with wonder. And it really came through to me at that moment that connection, reconnection to the mystery of life, the unknowingness of it seems to be profoundly important to her mental health and well-being. And it is so peculiar that that is the case.
Yeah. What a terrific observation. You know, as I wrote this book, Ronan, and you know, scientists like me who use data and inference and the like, we tend to shy away from mystery, what's unknown. You know, we try to explain what's known. But as writing this book, everywhere I turned, I was like, you know, fundamentally the big questions are mysteries, you know, music. How does music get into your brain and make you cry and get goosebumps and feel like you're part of a spiritual force? That's transcendent to me. I don't think science could ever understand that. And so I feel that awe has these interesting energies in them. And one is just mystery, that as you follow the course of awe through wonder, you get to deeper mysteries. And then you're like, I feel all about that mystery and I got to go further. So I think it's built into its DNA to thrive on mystery and to animate us in seeking mystery, which is wonderful. You know, you wouldn't expect it from a lot of conceptions of human nature, that we want to know what's certain. We got to have predictable rules of life. And in point of fact, we love mystery, and it's good. As you say, it's good for us, which is important.
It's the ultimate submission to a lack of control, right? Yeah, I think a lot of our struggles come from control. And when we're forced to give up control, we just have to submit to the experience. And that gives us a lot of freedom.
Yes. And surrender.
Okay, let's talk specifically about awe, because we've used the word a bunch of times. And I think everyone has some conceptual notion of what it is, but you propose a very specific definition of awe. Yeah. What is it, and why was that important in terms of the book? And I guess a corollary question is, and this is inspired just coming out of the conversation with Jack Feldman, is physiologically, what do we see happening when people experience awe?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's important. Science needs definitions. We need to say that awe is different from beauty or horror, which it is. And based on a survey of the philosophical literature, like Edmund Burke, based on a lot of spiritual, environmental, and psychedelic writing, I defined awe, and earlier with John Haidt, a great theorist, as an emotion that you have when you encounter vast mysteries, right? And we could sort of problematize those terms and get more specific, but I think that does a lot of good work for us. A big tree, the mycelial network, stars in the sky, somebody's courage in overcoming racism or prison, spiritual stuff. And so it's when we encounter vast mysteries. Awe, then the literature shows, as William James wrote about with respect to mystical feeling, has this unfolding subjectively, where you start to feel small, you feel connected to something large. Oh, the ecosystem, this group of people who love this band, etc. And it enables what James called the saintly tendencies, like you feel all, and you're like, I got to make the world better. You know, I don't know how, I just know that viscerally. And then finally, right. You know, 10, 15 years of science has really mapped the physiology of awe. And it's remarkable, which is, you know, you hear an incredible piece of music, you're out backpacking, you see someone whose moral beauty astounds you, their courage or kindness, and the self-focused regions of the brain default mode network are deactivated. The vagus nerve is activated. This region of your nervous system helps you open up and connect. You have one study, the release of oxytocin, a neuropeptide that helps you connect. You get the goosebumps, this really interesting piloerection response in the muscle. The hair follicles are on your muscles, the chills up your back that are part of a mammalian connection orientation. You have reduced inflammation in the immune system, which is very good for your body. So it's all about connecting to others and becoming big or expansive and connected to others. So it's almost the antithesis of fight or flight physiology, you know, of which narrows us and makes us think about the self. Awe opens us up to connect to others.
And from an evolutionary perspective, you suggest that there's rationale that awe is not necessarily just a connection to the divine, for lack of a better term, but yeah. there's reason that we experience this.
Yeah, thank you. You know, and it's back to the selfish gene. And, you know, there's been this, I remember, you know, to get detailed, Elliot Sober and David Sloan Wilson wrote about what's called group selection in the evolutionary argument literature, 1998, I think, where they said, there are a lot of reasons why we do better genetically if we get along in groups better. You know, our groups fend off other groups. We prevail in that kind of competition. We're better able to raise vulnerable offspring. We better able to hunt, etc. And I heard about that as a young scholar, and I was like, whoa, you know, it's almost about back to my Laurel Canyon days. Like, we are supposed to be communal, yeah. And that was an evolutionary argument in the abstract. And what that entails is that there are going to be all these adaptations that help us fold into strong groups. And the minute I heard that, I was like, well, awe, you know, we feel awe in religion and music and moving together and dance. And then we marshaled the right kind of data that show any experience of awe makes you feel like you're part of a collective. It changes your identity, where you suddenly define yourself in collective terms. It makes you cooperate better and share more. So that's why it's here from the evolutionary story or perspective, and why we need it deeply today, is we're missing that.
At one point in the book, you wrote, emotions have long been viewed as lower and animalistic, disruptive yeah. of lofty reason, which is considered humanity's highest achievement. Personally, I love this line as it resonates with one of the teachings that I've come across, that true intelligence is the intersection of logic and emotion, and that the most effective use of logic is to direct emotion effectively.
Yeah.
Do you think our loss of connection to emotion, to awe, to the mystery has been a driver in the mental health crisis that we're experiencing worldwide?
Yeah, I do. You know, man, you were asking good questions, Ronan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I surround myself with young people, and that's my career. I teach at a university. Right. I raised young daughters. I'm around 20-year-olds. And, you know, it's irrefutable worldwide, 30% rise depression, anxiety, especially hard hit. 20-year-olds, young people. Yeah. And we all feel it viscerally as parents and young people and observers. And when I look at the young people and then I think about, you know, like what I was like when I was 20, it's way too much stress today. Way too much envy through Instagram, way too much yep. fear. And then, you know, what I could work on, which is, you know, the loss of wonder, the loss of wandering. You know, my generation used to like, okay, I'm 21. I graduated college. I'm going to go wander around, you know, make some money and take a trip to Southeast Asia or what have you. And that's harder to find these days. And so, yeah, I think there have been a lot of forces that are working against this capacity for awe that is really needed in young people. I mean, it's a cardinal emotion for young people. It's central to like get blown away at music and then to pick up the guitar and play, you know? So, so we need it. I think younger folks like yourself are insisting upon it. You know, we're seeing the rise of festivals, for example. So, it's irrepressible, but yeah, I think it's very much tied to the mental health crisis we're feeling.
Yeah. Just, your comments just reminded me. So I was just at, a non-psychedelic retreat in Portugal. It was a coaching retreat called Becoming. And, one of the coaches, a woman named Carol, at our final kind of council circle, where we're all sharing what was top of mind, talked about, you know, a very traumatic experience. I won't repeat it out of respect for her privacy, but a very traumatic moment recently that involved her children, and, how she struggles with the absence of elders in our society.
Yeah,
you know, that, not only, you know, are we over dopamined, if I can turn that into a verb, are we over envied, but we also have a lack of, or we still have a disdain for wisdom and the elderly. You know, for my wife, Stephanie, and I talk about the fact that her grandmother, at the age of, I don't know, 55, which is not too far ahead of where we were, looked like a granny, right?
And
we kind of surmised that for most of human history, achieving what isn't even old age anymore, we'll call it sort of advanced middle age, was an achievement that was supposed to be admired and acknowledged. And now we look at the elderly as decrepit and kind of useless in this modern, fast moving world. And I think it's important to, you know, reclaim wisdom as a skill set that we should be cultivating.
Yeah. You know, and I love your question, Ronan. And, you know, you go to other cultures, India, Mexico, the elderly have a different standing and place in society. They live near the families and they have all this wisdom. I feel awe just looking at an old face and thinking, God, you know, imagine 9 decades here on Earth, on the planet. It astounds me. So I think we're missing that. And your observation, which is so astute and important, points to other sociological factors we should be thinking about that hurt our chances for awe, the right to awe, if you will, like, you know, having access to nature, or the diminishing skies at night, or, you know, so it's been interesting since publishing the book, because it's just made people reflect on like, God, I love this emotion. Why don't I have more of it? You know, I'm in conversation with a lot of medical doctors who are like, I went into medicine because it's awesome. And now the conditions of it prevent me from this feeling. So what do we do? Right. And they're taking active steps to return it to their work. And I think we need to do that in many ways.
Well, that's very cool. What has been this is a sidebar question, but what has been the response to the book? I surmise it's been mostly positive, but has there been any critical feedback?
Yeah. I mean, the response has been, you know, largely positive, you know, like, hey, we need this more today. Just like you said, like there is a mental health crisis and this can help us in medicine, in schools, in, you know, our national parks, et cetera. I think, and the other interesting area, that's been interesting for me is religion. Like a lot of religious leaders, from rabbis to Mormon elders to Catholic priests, have been teaching it and, you know, putting it into their teachings, because it's a language that a lot of people can relate to in terms of connecting to spirit. I think the critical feedback is, number one, this is just an emotion that's for privileged people or for privileged moments. You know, and I contest that, but I, you know, I've lost that battle. But, you know, poor people experience more awe empirically, and it doesn't take a lot of resources. But there has been a criticism there. Another interesting criticism that's going to be coming out in a Nautilus essay, and this is partially relevant to what you said earlier, which is that, hey, wait a minute. If everybody goes in search for awe or of awe, they're going to hurt the environment, right? They're going to go to the coral reefs that are awesome, but don't need humans with suntan lotion swimming by. So there's a worry, as always with humans, that if we pursue it with our passion, we hurt the environment. We hurt sacred sites in Mexico, et cetera. So I think that's, you know, that's legitimate. And then another criticism, sorry, is oops, this sets the stage for commodification. You know, like now they're going to be awe retreats and awe spas and, you know, awe curriculum, and we ruin the whole phenomenon. And, you know, maybe. And so I apologize. But I don't think so. I think there are a lot of good ways in which we can give this away in an environmentally friendly way for free.
Yeah, listen, I think by definition, the nature of awe is immune from commodification.
I hope.
But I,
yeah. Why do you say that? Well, give me the argument. I need it.
it's because of the nature of awe is that it, you know, it is fundamentally transcendent. I mean, we can get into the semantics of it, but like the nature of it is transcendent. It can't just be sold for the lowest bidder. I mean, in some ways it can be because, like, you know, as you pointed out, people who have lower income tend to experience more awe. And I actually want to ask that question to understand why. But if you think about it, who cares if it gets commodified, right? Like, it's commodification makes it cheap and worthless, but awe, I don't, by nature, can't be worthless just by virtue of what it is, right?
Right on. I hear you.
So I agree.
I think that awe has this resilience to it, and it's resistant to commodification, you know, like, okay, you can buy some awe from this vendor, you know. What the real awe, as Emerson encouraged us to think about, is what we find in our own way. And then, you know, another critique is, you know, is this what the demagogues of the world, the Hitlers and the Trumps, do? And that, you know, I think that's an empirical question, but interesting to think about, you know. So, you know, this is the point of doing science about basic human tendencies, is we have to place them in our cultural context and see how they're doing and seeing if they're bringing some good, and look to where there are perils for any kind of tendency.
Yeah, that's where my other question was going to go, which is, I do think it's immune from commodification because the nature of it is, it's endogenous, I guess, in some ways of speaking of it. And it's, it can be triggered through exogenous means, like taking psychedelics, for example. But the nature of psychedelics is that your body becomes used to it. And so you don't achieve necessarily the state of awe, but that's not because awe has been commodified, but the drug has been commodified to some degree. But awe remains, I think, by its nature, immune from that.
That's such a, in all my conversations and studies of awe for 15 years, this is one of the most original ideas I've heard. And I think you're right. I think there's something in literally the DNA of awe that, you know, it's like a basic state of mind, and it's, you can't alter it or corrupt it in some sense. And then the task is to create the context where we can really put it to good uses and feel it. And I think you're right, Ronan.
And find the paths, right?
And
that's actually, I'll skip my question 7, I'll go straight to question 8, but, you know, psychedelics are one path, but you say that there are 8 wonders of life that can trigger the experience of awe. What are they? And, what level of conviction do you have that there are only 8, or, did you just stop at 8?
Like, how come there, you know, this is where, the constraints of language really undermine true science. Like, I'm not going to tell you they're 92.
Yeah.
they're 8, and there are more. Yeah. So this was one of my favorite discoveries in all of this work on awe, which was, you know, my students and I were doing all this science that we've been talking about, and we were like, well, where do we find it? You know? And if you ask a person in Canada or California, they're like, oh, well, nature, you know, and maybe some music, and maybe some people are spiritual. And we were like, well, let's cast our net broadly, right? Let's get to many different cultures and let people tell us in their own words where they find awe. So we gathered 2,600 stories of awe from around the world, from 26 countries, from India and Brazil and Mexico and Chile and Poland and Canada, just all over. And then we coded them. It took a long time to translate and code them. And what we come up with are 8 wonders that account for about 90% of all experiences, which is moral beauty, you know, the courage and kindness of other people and their overcoming, collective movement in dance and sports, nature, then you get to music, visual design, and spirituality, and then big ideas like consciousness, you know, and life and death, which meant a lot to me writing the book. So those are 8. And to your question, you know, and I get this all the time. I got this just a couple of days ago, talking to Berkeley undergrads, like, what about food? I'm like, sorry, you can't have awe with food, you know? But yeah, for, you know, there are these more less common examples, sex, food, sensations, like, man, sometimes, you know, just feeling the sun on my skin gives me awe. So there are a lot of more infrequent examples, but those 8 cover a lot of territory, right, of where we find it.
So my question before that was, you wrote Awe is about our relationship to the vast mysteries of life.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask the question, do you think that's accurate, or is awe in fact the connection to the vast mysteries of life?
What was the first statement that I apparently wrote?
So the difference is the word about. You said awe is about our relationship to the vast mysteries of life. And as I thought about it, I'm like, maybe awe is, you know, that cord that connects us to the mysteries, right?
Really well put.
But I hadn't thought through it more. Are there other paths to the vast mysteries of life, I guess, is the nature of the question, or is awe really the one?
Well, you know, first of all, your parsing of words is really illuminating for our understanding of this mysterious emotion, right? There's one tradition in understanding emotions that comes out of Aristotle and philosophy, what they call the intentional object or the aboutness of the emotion. And so if you want to know what your friend thinks of awe, ask them what it's about. And she or he will say, or they, like, oh, it's about when I read about Gandhi, and it just made me feel awe. So about really matters. Your point, I think, gets to the experience of the emotion rather than the reporting upon it, which is emotions are relational, you know, and compassion is when you relate to people who are suffering, and love when somebody you desire, and anger, somebody you're protesting injustice toward. And awe is how we relate to vast mysteries, and you're right on in your analysis. Are there other paths to mysteries than awe? I think, you know, a lot of theorists right now, David Yeadon at Johns Hopkins, are interested in these transcendent emotions, right? That get us out of our narrow view of the world to the what's mysterious, aesthetic emotions, spiritual emotions, psychedelic emotions. And I think that broad class of emotions covers a lot of our relationality to what's mysterious about existence. And so I would say, yeah, it's probably the central pathway.
I know it's a little bit definitional, and
I
apologize. I'm a lawyer by training. So, you know, I've spent a lot of time focusing on precision of writing, because I mean, if there's anything that is the most conventional definition of awful, it's legal drafting, and not in the nice way, but the truly terrible way. But it taught me a lot of respect for the importance of precision of words.
Yeah.
In the same token, though, at a retreat I was at two years ago now, with Bessel van der Kolk and others, where we were doing ketamine-assisted therapy with psychodrama as a technique, which was fascinating. One of the participants pointed out a thought that I had never crossed my mind, but was profound to me, where she said, you know, the nature of emotions, and this is very Alan Watts oriented, I guess, as well, is like the nature of emotions are not really conducive to words. So how stifling is it to say to a child, use your words to try and communicate what they're feeling, right? Like that is such a limiting way that like the intensity of the emotion, I don't know if you can see my hands in the camera right now, is this big, but the biggest words we may have to express it may only be this big. And that's inherently by its nature stifling. So playing with words, you know, besides satisfying that legal part of my brain that I consistently try to repress, also gives us a way to expand the scope of what we're talking about. Because like when you put a different word in, it really changes the nature of what you're reading or experiencing.
Yeah, no. And, you know, that's why in the book, like, And I would even go one step further and say, you know, measures are inherently limiting in and limited in trying to understand subjective feeling. And I bumped into that. And so in our field and in the book, I rely on like, give people some spiritual writing and just read that, right? Show them some images. Images bring us awe as a, and a way to understand it. And there's a deep point that your commentary leads to that actually I hadn't really thought deeply about until this book and Edmund Burke, which is words don't necessarily correspond to feelings. You know, they're and they feelings are these mysterious forces that include body sensations and, you know, sort of the registering of what's happening in your heart and, you know, what's happening outside and metaphors and image. Words are just the tip of the iceberg. And so we need a lot of ways to understand a feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to hear music and dance and move our bodies. And that was a real challenge in this book. And I got way beyond traditional measures and single words to get to little snippets of poetry and stories and see if we can get there.
One of the things that came up as I was thinking about it, one of the first notes I took while reading the book was, and I think it's emblematic of a lot of what's going on in society right now, is that I think by its nature, awe is a very intense emotion. And I know certainly myself, you know, intensity is hard for me. It scares me because, and again, just at this retreat last week in Portugal, Carol, the person I mentioned before about talking about elders, she was also the one leading, you know, the rage exercises where we beat the living snot out of a tree with bamboo. And again, the intensity is terrifying because you kind of lose yourself, and we love losing ourselves in positive emotion and love and connection in those big moments. But when it comes to the more, I won't say negative, but more challenging emotions of, you know, rage, anger, hurt, I know certainly myself fear losing who I am or what I am, you know, to those emotions. And I don't know if you encountered any of that in this exploration about the balancing, not balancing, that's not the right word, but whether there's pushback about the pursuit of awe or engaging an awe practice, like we people engage a gratitude practice because of the nature of the intensity of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, awe is more, as one of my grad students put it, destabilizing, right? It's like an emotion that, because of its mystery, makes us question the big assumptions of the world, right? And about a quarter of experiences of awe in not only in ordinary lab science that I do, but the psychedelic science with the awe-eliciting compounds are terrifying and destabilizing and alienating. And you get close to horror and meaninglessness. And so, I think there are perils in this emphasis because of the intensity of awe. What I really take heart in, though, is I do feel, you know, first of all, there's a lot of sort of lower level versions of awe that are common, you know, just get out. I just had my undergrads get outside and look up at the sky and look at the clouds, right? Whoa, I didn't realize there are so many clouds today, you know? So they're softer, easier versions of awe. that are accessible. And then I'd also say, you know, Ronan, when I look at the mental health crisis that you referred to, one of the sources is just the overemphasis on self. I think that's why psychedelics are so popular right now, because it gives people a freedom from the self. And awe does that.
Yep.
And so even though it can be anxiety producing, I think we need to be a little less guided by that very loud voice of the self.
In homage to the fact that you used the word woe a second ago, for people listening, you know, what we've talked about awe, and we put a definition around it, you know, the vast mysteries, or connection to the vast mysteries. But how does one identify when they're experiencing a moment of awe? Because I'm certain that there are people out there being like, is this what awe feels like? And, you know, much like flow states, as soon as you're aware that you're in a flow state, you're not in a flow state. And I imagine much like awe, as soon as you become aware that you're in awe, you're probably not in awe. But what are the telltale signs that someone is experiencing awe?
Yeah, it's a really, you know, it's a really interesting question. And it's part of our broader conversation. Like, how do I know I'm feeling this, right? How does it register in consciousness? And I think, you know, you're feeling awe when the first answer is the William James answer. Like, you feel it in your body. You know, you're like, I'm getting goosebumps. And when I ask people about goosebumps, and we've done research on that, it gets them close to awe, certain kinds of chills. Those register in our brains, right? Or when you tear up or get that lump in your throat as a source of awe. A second sense of awe, where we're starting to feel like, yeah, this is it, is the, and this is seen in spiritual writing, nature writing, psychedelic writing, and lab science, replicable lab science, is you just feel like you're disappearing, you know, right. You're like, wow, I'm kind of dissolving here. You know, I'm starting to become aware of vast things around me, because my sense of self is really diminishing, and I feel quiet. I feel humble. I feel like listening. I feel like I'm observing rather than acting. All of these fadings of the self. And I think that's a second big clue to feeling awe, is the ego death in the psychedelic literature, or small self, we call it.
I found it fascinating that when in the book, you talked about the experiment when you sent people outside and some people walked around. This is specifically, I think, in respect of access to nature as a path to awe. You know, people would walk around, and when they took a selfie in an uninspiring place, you know, their heads would take up the vast majority of the selfie. But as people moved into nature, you know, much more of the background became prominent in the photographs.
Yeah, thank you. That was Virginia Sturm and I. You know, you do your awe walk compared to a nice control condition. We had them take selfies out on that walk, finding awe. And they're smiling more, feeling awe. And then they kind of vanish. They start moving off to the corner of the photo, because you're always interested in the big context of life, right? Even in that taking of a selfie. So it tells you how powerful that phenomenon is. And I love that finding.
Yeah, that's super fascinating. Hey, it's also, I mean, it's a reflection of cell phones that, like, we've become so accustomed to selfies, like, become the default. You know, it's probably evidence of the symptoms and symptomatic of where we've gone as a culture, undoubtedly. One thing I wanted to talk about, which is less pleasant, and you touched on it before we go back to a more pleasant way to wind up this conversation, is awe. The paths to awe are not always, you know, roses and rainbows and wonderful things. That some of the ways are very unpleasant paths to awe. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, it is striking over the years, Ronan. I've studied compassion, which emerges, as the Buddhists tell us, when we grapple with human suffering. You know, gratitude often happens in contexts of scarcity. I feel really grateful I can eat today. And awe happens in a lot of hard places, like combat, in prisons, and death, you know. And I use the word, you know, rather than passing and so forth, because I think we need to stop sanitizing it. And our data revealed something really striking, which is, you know, around the world, You know, when you see people suffer and then they pass away, you feel awe. You know, people commonly feel awe. I remember this story from, I think, Indonesia, where the son was watching his mom pass away and he was just overwhelmed by her life and her presence and the vastness of her life and the mystery of her passing, and was like, and like we've been talking, you know, like he didn't know how he would find meaning again, you know. And awe is very closely connected to the hard things in life, trauma, combat, passing away, death, and so forth. And I think the reason why is it's this fundamental way in which we create new realities where they're safe and strong. And there's a very deep interest right now by Tedeschi and others in post-traumatic growth. And that awe right. plays a role in post-traumatic growth. You know, you know, near-death experiences are interesting, where you can have this heart attack or car crash, and you're just awestruck by life. Like, whoa, I'm still here. What do I do about that?
Yeah.
And so, you know, thank you for putting it so clearly and baldly. Like, awe is right there in the hard stuff. And so now we have to figure out how to grow individually and create sort of institutions that help us with that. And that's a challenge of the book.
On that note, you know, friends of mine wrote a book called The 5-Minute Journal. I don't know if you've come across that in your work, but
I haven't.
The idea is that journaling is great for us, but most people don't know how to do it, don't want to spend the time doing it properly. And so the 5-Minute Journal is a very simple practice in which to undertake a gratitude practice to double up on the word there. And what advice do you have for anybody listening about how to cultivate a practice of awe?
Yeah. Yeah. We're really turning to that with full force, and we've tested these practices scientifically, as have, you know, there are pretty cool awe interventions coming out of China, Chinese research. Awe walks, look for awe when you're walking, you know, visually.
Yep.
When you look at the sky or the sunset, go from small to vast. That's a powerful pathway to awe. Writing about awe is a good gateway to awe. Reflecting on someone who has moved you, right? Which I do as a contemplative practice. And then, you know, we tested in the peak of the pandemic, you know, we got medical doctors and nurses and health practitioners. And this is reported in a book by Michael Amster and Jake Eagle, you know, just a practice of awe, like take a minute, slow down, take a breath, put away your devices, and just think about like, what was mysterious here? What was vast? What are you connected to? You know, just in our conversation right now, Ronan, I'm like, man, think about the questions that Ronan asked you remotely over this recording and how deep they are and how we're sharing ideas. So there are always moments of awe we can get close to. So they've tested a really nice practice of it that we found was beneficial for doctors' mental health. There are a lot of ways to get to awe.
Cool. Have you ever read the book by Jamie Weil, Recapture the Rapture?
I haven't.
Have you heard of it?
No, I like the title.
Yeah, it's Recapture the Rapture, something in a world that's lost its mind. Recapture the Rapture, rethinking sex, death, and meaning in a world that's lost its mind, something along those lines. And it touches on a lot of this stuff, that there's a lot of ways to tap into these transcendent experiences through breath work, through collective dance.
Yeah.
You know, all of these things. And I think you'd find it interesting. And interestingly, Jamie, who's been on the podcast and without question, one of the smartest guys I've ever met, you know, I don't think I'm super smart, but I can keep up with most people. Jamie's one of those people that I just can't keep up with. Like, it is a real race to try and keep up with this line of thinking. But it's a beautiful book, and he wrote it as a kind of post-apocalyptic instruction manual in case things go sideways, so people can rediscover some of these essential emotions and experiences. So I certainly recommend you check it out.
I'll take a look.
What's in store for 2024 for you in terms of personal or professional interests?
Yeah, you know, thank you for asking that. I've been really, awe touched a nerve. I think people hunger for it. And so we're working on promoting awe in schools through the Greater Good Science Center, museums, through Carnegie Hall and the National Gallery in the United States. There's a Cities of Awe movement that people are interested in. Yeah, just like, how do we return? And then, you know, my next substantive area is moral beauty. You know, just this amazing capacity we have to just tear up at other people's kindness and courage, and how fundamental that is to healthy societies, and how it's been gutted by cynicism and Trump and Yelp and Facebook, you know, Meta, and you know, and so it's a fight we need to fight. That we need, just like you said earlier, like, you know, the selfish gene view really got into our culture, you know, and it's an old one and it's got a lot of truth to it. But we also need to remember all the good things we do. So I'll be working on that.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. Cities of Awe sounds like a really cool project as one part of that.
Yeah,
You know, and I put this out there because I think it's important. I remember for a long time growing up, I was fairly cynical. it's been a many year journey, a 15 year journey for me about rediscovering emotions, because I became really good at not feeling emotions for a variety of reasons that anyone listening has probably heard many times. So I won't repeat them again. And I remember, and it's only top of mind because I was listening to the podcast Smartless. If you haven't listened to it and want to laugh, it's a great podcast with Jason Bateman and Will Arnett and Sean Hayes, and they had Emma Stone on, and Emma Stone was in La La Land. And I remember sitting there on a plane watching La La Land and tearing up. And my first reaction was like, this is stupid. Like, you know, this is just fiction. Why am I sitting here like wasting my time watching some work of fiction? And then it just struck me, being like, who cares if it's artificial? Who cares if it's constructed scenarios? It's helping me tap into a feeling, an emotion that's making me choke up. And isn't that beautiful and something that we should be celebrating? And
it's one of the most remarkable parts of the human mind is just what you described.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah, we can look at something, it's like, you know, that's not true and still get that feeling.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's moral beauty in some sense. And to me, it's a big mystery of, you know, you hear a piece of music and it kind of makes you think about your mother or grandmother, and you're like, you start weeping and you're like, wow, this is deep. And it's a animating force in creativity, and I think worth talking about.
Yep. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for making the time. This has been a really delightful conversation, and I'm very inspired by your work and everything you're doing, because I think the world needs a lot more of this and needs to reconnect to awe and all of these transcendent experiences and reconnect to the mystery. And every piece we can do, every voice out there doing this kind of work, I think it needs to be, you know, applauded. And yeah, so thank you. Thank you for making the time. Thank you for writing the book, and thank you for your future delve into moral beauty. I think that's
thank you, Ronan. And I enjoyed this conversation immensely, and scribbling down notes of things that I need to read, but more importantly, perhaps things I need to study, you know, because your questions really opened up a lot of mysteries for me. So thank you. Oh,
wonderful. I'm glad it was an intriguing conversation. So thank you, Dacher. It's been awesome.
All right. Awesome. Thanks, Ronan.
Thank you. Have a great day. Thank you. Bye-bye.